Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Coming up on the broadcast, food trends from A to Z. That's ancient grains to Zima. We meet the increasingly elusive first-time homebuyer. And on Memorial Day, a new program that helps vets with PTSD. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Washington, I'm David Gura in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Monday, May 26th, Memorial Day, and it's great to have you with us. On the heels of a surprise trip to Afghanistan, President Obama visited Arlington National Cemetery today. Memorial Day is an opportunity, the president said, to rededicate ourselves to our sacred obligations to all who wear America's uniform.
As we've been reminded in recent days, we must do more to keep faith with our veterans and their families and ensure they get the care and benefits and opportunities that they've earned and that they deserve.
Readjusting to civilian life can be difficult for veterans, so on this Memorial Day, Marketplace's Nancy Marshall Genzer introduces us to a group of vets of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan who, in an effort to cope with post-traumatic stress, have turned to farming.
The first time Sonia Kendrick got out in her fields of tomatoes, cucumbers, and corn, something magical happened.
It was as if the earth had grounded me.
Kendrick served in the Army and National Guard for 9 years, including an eight-month stint in Afghanistan. She has PTSD. Around 2009, she started farming in her hometown near Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Kendrick says veterans like her don't want office jobs. She says when you've almost lost your life repeatedly, it's hard to care about office rules. So farming's perfect.
But you're not in a cubicle playing bureaucratic rules. I don't think that we enjoy.
So many veterans have turned to farming. The Agriculture Department has created special programs to help them. The department says 45% of service members are from rural areas. Nonprofits are springing up to teach them how to farm. Groups like Growing Warriors, based on a spread in eastern Kentucky, where three veterans have started up their tractor for some spring planting. Kevin Lanzi is the farm manager. He's been farming for about 5 years. He's a former Marine who spent almost a year and a half in Iraq. Lanzi says he spent years trying to find himself after leaving the military.
I finally found farming, and ever since, I've never looked back. Just seeing what you're making, you know, it's the responsibility is all you, and it's awesome.
Craig Bryan is head of the National Center for Veteran Studies at the University of Utah. I asked him why farming seems to help veterans with PTSD.
Because they're distracted, right? They're engaged in something that's fun and they don't necessarily have to think about, or it's easier to avoid those memories and thoughts of the traumatic event.
But Bryan says farming only offers temporary relief from PTSD symptoms, and veterans suffering from it still need therapy. Those I talked to all have done therapy. They say it helps, but only if they can farm, too. I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
Maybe you've paid a little extra for a bar of chocolate or a bag of coffee beans with a fair trade label. The idea is the additional money goes to better the lives of farmers and workers in developing countries. Well, a new study from the University of London looking at coffee, tea, and flour producers in Ethiopia and Uganda questions how much fair trade is actually helping them. Marketplace's Mark Garrison reports.
The study finds some workers at fair trade sites earning less than those that aren't fair trade. Economist Christopher Kramer, one of the study's authors, spoke to our partners at the BBC.
If people think that fair trade is in the very best interest of the poorest people, then there are serious problems.
Fair Trade International, which sets standards, is pushing back. CEO Harriet Lamb says the study makes unfair comparisons involving workers on very small plots of land.
It compared the conditions they're in with those of a plantation run by a multinational in the same area. Now, that's not fair.
Bigger companies can pay better because of their larger scale, though the British researchers say they account for that. They want shoppers to have more information. Cornell economist Arnab Basu studies fair trade but isn't involved in this research. He says fair trade buyers are informed overall but often don't know the details.
There is a bit of a misperception as to what they're actually doing and who they're really helping.
And Lamb at Fairtrade International points out there's only so much most shoppers can take in.
As a busy mother or father going around the supermarket, your kids are screaming and you want to play your part in tackling poverty. there's really a limit to the amount of information that you can seek out or look for on one small chocolate bar, one small pack of coffee.
Kramer says fair trade does do good, and Lamb says his study makes valid points about the challenge of making sure fair trade money flows all the way through from farmers to farm hands. I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
Here in the U.S., markets were closed for Memorial Day. They were open elsewhere. Details when we do the numbers. Maybe you've wondered, as I have, why certain foods become so popular and how it seems to happen so quickly. Quinoa, the Andean supergrain, is everywhere. The same thing is true of bacon. Now, Subway sells a chicken melt made with sriracha sauce. Well, David Sachs has looked into the business behind all this. He's the author of a new book called The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. And he joins us from Toronto. Hey, David.
Hi, David.
In your book, you introduce us to people who forecast trends for a living. And I'm just thinking that, you know, forecasting, predicting trends, that must have been a lot easier before smartphones and social media.
While the business of predicting trends used to, you know, be a much longer term thing, because trends would take a longer time to trickle down from the restaurant world and fine dining and sort of gourmets into middle market neighborhood bistros and then eventually into sort of supermarket products and stuff that you would get at fast food chains. Today, that evolution is happening a lot quicker. And the Cronut example of last summer is really great. Less than 2 months after its birth, it was an item that was sold at Dunkin' Donuts in South Korea as, you know, the New York pie donut. But essentially, it had been sort of appropriated into the corporate food stream, which is something that you didn't see beforehand. It would have taken years, if not, you know, a decade or more for food trends to really trickle down that way.
Is it possible to generalize sort of how long it takes for an idea to be ginned up in a lab or in someone's kitchen to go all the way to, say, the checkout aisle at a Costco or at a Walmart?
I think it's a process of several years, the best case scenario being something like a Cronut. But on average, let's take some other item, you know, kale salads. To make that leap to the point where you can buy, you know, huge boxes of kale at Costco, it really needs to cross a certain threshold in terms of its size and market share, because the big food companies don't generally jump into these things willy-nilly. They want to see that there's a sufficient scale and market size and demand for it in order to make the investment that's necessary to make it profitable. And that still takes the span of a year or 2 years.
So how does that happen? How does Subway start selling a sub with sriracha on it?
This stuff kind of pops up on their radar early. So either food companies like Subway will have, you know, people in their recipe development section that as part of their job, you know, they're supposed to keep track of trends. And they also read trade and industry publications, which talk about how sales are doing, what sort of demographics factor into this. Is there a higher level of immigration from Southeast Asia? And so, you know, it's on their radar years before it ever enters the sandwich, but they'll also back it up by taking executives from Subway, let's say, on a tour of Vietnamese and Thai neighborhoods in Southern California and showing them the different things that they could have. Now, they're not going to go and create this Subway banh mi, you know, Vietnamese sub sandwich, but they'll take certain ideas from it, bring it back to headquarters. When it comes out of the other end as the Subway chicken sriracha sub, it's been engineered to appeal to the largest mass market audience as possible.
So it's Memorial Day here in the U.S., and I wonder, is there a food trend now that you see coming to the fore in the spring as we turn into summer?
One that I've always hoped I would see more of, and I'm betting on personally, is Argentinian-style barbecue. Huh. We've seen sort of the elements of it coming out with chimichurri, which is this sort of basting sauce marinade. It's almost like a salad dressing. But there's a number of companies and a number of places that are increasingly doing sort of wood-fired barbecue. This is just sort of campfire cooking directly over a flame. And I think we're going to see more and more of this first in restaurants, and then in the coming years, you're going to start seeing people doing it in homes and, you know, Walmart barbecuing kits. So I think this Memorial Day, if the weather's good where you live, break out a wood fire and start cooking your steaks over that. You'll appreciate it much more.
David Sachs' new book is called The Tastemakers, Why We're Crazy for Cupcakes but Fed Up with Fondue. Thanks, David.
My pleasure. Thanks, David.
Of course, one of the biggest food trends in recent memory is the cupcake. Full story on the surprising origin of that one is at marketplace.org. Facebook recently announced new gender options. Users can change their profiles to indicate they are transgender, transsexual, transfeminine. There are a lot of options, more than 50 of them. For companies, making the choice to recognize and even showcase identifiers like these is becoming popular. Sally Herships has more.
Let's get real. How exciting can an ad for a mop be?
Like, you can only show how many after pictures of a clean floor and a dirty mop.
Jen Drexler is with Insight Strategy Group, a market research firm. And we're talking about the ads for Swiffer featuring real married couples. One couple is biracial, and the husband lost part of his arm to cancer.
When you only have one hand, you're not doing anything as fast as you used to. Which is funny, because I still do it better than her.
Swiffer says the couple in its ad, the Rukavinas, represents the evolution of the American family.
And what I love about what they're doing, they're showing a different side, a real, like, advertising catching up with demographics of these interesting families.
Drexler says ads like Swiffer's have moved beyond the functional to emotionally connect with consumers.
This is so different. It's not testimonials. It is real life situations that have humor and a level of gravity to it that reflect what's happening for all of us.
Cheerios also has an ad with a biracial family, and fashion brands represent a changing social reality, too. New ads for Diesel feature a model in a wheelchair, and Barney's has transgender models. The company even shot a half-hour film telling its models' stories.
I am a guy. I just happen to be born a girl.
As soon as a baby's born, you put all these expectations and roles on them. Take that.
The famous fashion photographer Bruce Weber shot Barney's campaign. And if you didn't know the models are transgender, you'd think it was just another high fashion photo shoot. But we know it's not.
What the Barney's ads are doing is making you pause and look. And that is a real challenge for any brand.
Candice Corlett is president of WSL Strategic Retail. She says, say you're flipping through a typical fashion magazine.
Just about all the models are Caucasian. And most of them blonde.
Barney's models will stand out. The store says it wants to help break stereotypes. But when you use a model in a wheelchair or with only one arm, who's benefiting? Riley Pojensky is one of Barney's new transgender models.
And I think before people are quick to judge what this might mean for Barney's sales, what they should really recognize is that 17 people stepped forward and said, you are going to accept us for the people we are. Your consumers are going to accept us for the people we are.
Candice Corlett says that's what brands are hoping for.
We are going to reach out to our audience, and we're counting on our audience to say, yes, we're for inclusion. It's almost a political statement on the brands that usually like to play it very safe.
Like Cheerios, Banana Republic, or Coke. Corlett says for some brands, ad showing a changing social reality is a risk. But Swiffer says we should expect to see more ads with real families. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
Coming up, the beer business has changed a lot in the last 20 years.
You have people starting up with tiny breweries, making like 2 kegs a day or something like that, and only selling in their neighborhood.
Still trying to find the guy doing that on my street. But first, let's do the numbers. U.S. markets were closed today in observance of Memorial Day. They'll reopen tomorrow with the S&P 500 at a record 1,900, up just under 3% for the year so far. In Japan, the Nikkei closed up 1% in light trading. And trading was light worldwide because today was a bank holiday in the U.K. European markets rose even after anti-immigrant and nationalist parties made strong showings in elections for the European Parliament. U.S. bond markets were closed, and you are listening to Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at what's coming up Tuesday. In Washington, President Obama will host the 2014 White House Science Fair. Want a Facebook chat with the U.S. Secretary of Labor? Well, you can. He'll be participating in his first live Q&A to discuss increasing minimum wage and equal pay. And on this day in 1937, 200,000 pedestrians crossed San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge on its opening day. Cars weren't allowed on the span until the next day. I'm Daisy Palacios.
This is Marketplace. I'm David Gura, in for Kai Rizdahl. I was out for a walk yesterday, and I noticed a lot of for sale signs in my neighborhood here in D.C. It's almost June, the final month of the spring home buying season. At open houses these days, you're less and less likely to find first-time home buyers. At one point, half of all homes sold went to first-time home buyers, and now it's about a third. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour explains what they're up against.
Kevin Erspommer lives in Brooklyn. He's been thinking about buying a home for the first time.
Probably for about 6 months or so on and off.
His verdict?
We're holding off for now.
The prices have been high, for starters, sometimes rising 30% in just the time he's been looking. And another problem.
The open houses are completely full, and the guy's like, we've had a number of offers over asking price, including all cash offers, in which makes you feel a little discouraged in the sense that, why would they ever accept my offer with financing if they have an all-cash offer?
In the first quarter of 2014, 43% of U.S. residential property sales were all cash.
That's the highest number we've ever seen, and it's really an astounding number.
Darren Bloomquist is vice president of RealtyTrack. So who are these people who can lay down cash like this?
Investors, just regular investors, as well as we've seen a new breed of investors enter this market, institutional investors that are backed by hedge funds.
In some markets, foreign buyers are the problem, but there's also a big domestic competitor.
You also do have retirees who are selling their homes in other parts of the country, and they're downsizing.
It might seem easy to blame Wall Street and grandma, but there's actually more going on, says Chris Mayer, professor of real estate at Columbia Business School.
In a sense, you could say it's crowding out, but it's really just a reflection of the challenges that younger households are having coming into the market to buy a first home.
Credit is still tight, mortgages are more expensive, student loans hurt, and prices are rising. In the short term, that's not changing. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
And if you're thinking about buying, some tips are on our website. That's marketplace.org. A look now at the economics of childbirth. In this country, one in three babies is born by C-section. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, in 2012, there were more than 1 million cesarean deliveries in the U.S. But the rates of C-sections vary widely by state and even by hospital. The American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology has called for fewer C-sections. Gigi Duban reports on how that may play out.
These days, Sarah Beth Matthews just can't seem to get comfortable. She gets up in the middle of the night to go to the bathroom. She's lugging extra weight around. Normal stuff when you're 38 weeks pregnant.
Any complaints today?
Just lots of pressure.
Okay, that's good.
I feel my body change.
I like to hear that you're having some pressure. That tells me that the cervix is getting ready.
She's come in for a checkup with Sarah Altman, an obstetrician at Brookwood Medical Center. A quick listen to the baby's heartbeat.
140s, completely normal.
When it comes time to deliver this baby, Altman has no plans to rush to do a C-section.
Now we recognize that it's safe to let a woman continue to try and labor.
That falls right in line with guidelines issued recently by the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists and the Society for Maternal Fetal Medicine. They essentially say wait and give moms a chance to deliver vaginally. Aaron Coy is an obstetrician who helped draft the new guidelines.
This document is about being patient.
But experts say that's easier said than done. And for those in the business of delivering babies, the change is going to affect the bottom line. Coy says recently hospitals have pushed to cut C-section rates. Hospitals charge more for C-sections, but they also cost more.
Women stay longer after C-sections. They require more intensive nursing care. They require more intensive OR care.
So what about obstetricians who feel pressured to deliver as many babies as they can?
It does lead to us being patient and waiting for longer periods of time. So if it's, you know, Friday at 8 p.m. and, you know, I could be at home, instead, I'm going to hang out and see if someone's cervix will change.
So they might lose a little more sleep, but they're not likely to make much more money. Neil Shaw is a Harvard Medical School obstetrician based at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. He's studied the cost of labor.
you know, the hospital might make more money on a C-section, but the person who makes the decision to do the C-section doesn't necessarily make more money.
In fact, one report says out of the private insurance payout on a vaginal birth, OBGYNs get a 25% slice of the pie. That's slightly more than the 21% they get for a C-section. Still, Shaw says C-sections are faster than vaginal deliveries. So if an obstetrician is paid per delivery, more is better.
The longer that labor lasts, the more attractive it might be, or the stronger the incentive might be to offset your workload by just getting her delivered.
So if a woman has been pushing and grunting for 3 hours, and now she's got to wait an extra hour or two before her doctor resorts to a C-section, the rush to hear this is real. In Birmingham, I'm Gigi Duban for Marketplace.
Back in 1965, Fritz Maytag, an heir to the Maytag family fortune, saved the Anchor Brewing Company from bankruptcy. And he did it by making beers that were, shall we say, more complex than what was widely available back then. Steve Hindy credits Maytag with starting the craft beer revolution. That's the title of Hindy's new book, and he's not just an author. Hindy co-founded the Brooklyn Brewery. Hi, Steve.
How you doing, David?
I want to jog your memory here, Steve. Back when you were in college, what did beer taste like?
Oh, my God. Drinking beer at Cornell in the late 60s. I think they had Rheingold on tap. But, you know, beer didn't have a lot of flavor back then. The craft beer revolution has introduced such a wide range of different styles and flavors to the beer world that a lot of people are now turned on to flavor in beer.
I'm looking at the appendix in the back of your book, and there's a list of the top breweries and how much beer they make. And at the top of that list is Anheuser-Busch and Miller. And these are companies that are brewing hundreds of millions of gallons of beer a year.
When I started in business with Brooklyn Brewery in 1988, imports were about 3% of the U.S. beer market. And the other 97 was the national brewers in America. There were only about 50 breweries in America at that time. And people said to me, are you crazy? How can you compete with these giants? And my answer was, well, we're really going to be competing with the imported beers. We're going to be making beer with flavor. We're going to be making English-style ales and German-style lagers. But actually, what's happened in the last 25 years is that imported beer has continued to grow. And craft beer, the kind of beer I make at Brooklyn Brewery, is now about 10% of the U.S. market. So, you know, we are tiny compared to those giants, but we're gaining.
I mean, I love the label on your beer, and that's something that you put a lot of thought into. You had the guy who designed the I Heart New York logo design the label on your beer.
Yes, that was one of the better moves I made early on, is getting Milton Glaser to design the label. Actually, in the beginning, I wanted to call the beer Brooklyn Eagle Beer, after the old Brooklyn Eagle newspaper. And I remember the first meeting with Milton. I kind of told him what I wanted to do, and I said I wanted, you know, I wanted this image to project the Brooklyn Bridge and the Dodgers. And the first thing he said was, look, we got Brooklyn here. Forget the Eagle. Call it Brooklyn Beer. It fits.
I wonder where you see craft brewing headed. Is it to sour beers? Is it to beers that incorporate more local ingredients, say grains grown locally? Where do you see, just in terms of the taste of beer, things headed?
The breweries who are, you know, there are 2,800 breweries across the United States. There are 2,000 breweries in the works now. And the breweries that are starting up are using all different kind of business models. You have people starting up with tiny breweries, making like 2 kegs a day or something like that, and only selling in their neighborhood. And the styles of beer are as varied as anywhere in the world. I mean, it's remarkable the innovation that's happening here with sour beers, with barrel-aged beers. Actually, I just got an email today from someone in Brazil who was talking about a beer that has ants in it, A-N-T-S, yes.
For the protein. Yeah.
And asking me what I thought of that. I told him I thought it sounded kind of creepy. But I'm very confident, though, that craft beer is here to stay.
Steve Hindy co-founded the Brooklyn Brewery. He's the author of The Craft Beer Revolution. Thanks, Steve.
Thank you, David.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note, doctors at a hospital in Pittsburgh plan to put 10 patients in suspended animation, or suspended life, as they call it. I'm not sure that sounds any better, but CNET reports the technique will initially be used on 10 patients whose wounds would otherwise be lethal in an attempt to buy surgeons more time. They'll replace the patient's blood with a saline solution, so for a few hours, the body won't need oxygen, and the docs will be able to do what they need to do. This has been done on pigs successfully. This will be the first time it's been done on humans. And that's Marketplace from American Public Media. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner, Tommy Andres, Millie Jefferson, and Melissa Yeager-Miller. I'm David Gura. We'll meet you back here tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.